Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are cracking open the file on, well, perhaps the most enduring, most complex, and arguably the most analyzed person of the 20th century. We are diving into the foundational history, the contradictions, and the explosive legacy of Marilyn Monroe.
It's a fascinating challenge, you know, because this is a story that has been so thoroughly mythologized.
Right.
The real woman, Norma Jean Mortensen, she often just gets lost in the, I guess, the platinum haze.
Yeah, completely.
Our mission today is to move past that simple, dumb, blonde caricature and really try to understand the profound shrewdness, the relentless ambition.
And the struggle.
And the deep abiding struggles of the woman who engineered one of the biggest cultural phenomena in history.
And the success she achieved in her, what, her brief 36 years is just staggering.
It's unbelievable.
By the time of her death in 1962, her films had already grossed $200 million. We're talking about an equivalent of nearly $2 billion today. She wasn't just a movie star. She was, you know, alongside figures like Elvis Presley and Mickey Mouse, a true pillar of global popular culture.
Exactly. And we need to trace that dramatic path, starting from a truly unstable and traumatic childhood, through the highly disciplined, intentional creation of the Marilyn persona, her revolutionary battles with the Hollywood studio system.
The entrenched studio system.
Right. And ultimately, her tragic final years. It was a short life, but every single year was packed with calculated defiance and just devastating personal conflict.
Let's unpack this. You cannot understand the driving force behind Marilyn without first really digging into the profound insecurity and the emotional isolation that defined Norma Jean. She was born on June 1st, 1926 in Los Angeles. And I mean, right from the start, there was huge uncertainty about who her father was.
And that really set the tone for her whole life, didn't it? This search for identity, for belonging.
Absolutely. That's the crux of her origin story.
It is. Her mother, Gladys Pearl Baker, who was a film negative cutter at the time, listed a man named Mortensen, misspelled as Mortensen, as the father on the birth certificate.
But they weren't even together then.
No, that union had already ended well before Gladys became pregnant. So biographers today, they widely suggest the biological father was actually Charles Stanley Gifford.
Who was her boss, right?
Her superior in RKO Studios, yeah. And that relationship was, well, it was basically confirmed by DNA evidence just a few years ago, back in 2022.
So she starts her life surrounded by mystery, instability, and kind of the shadow of the film industry itself.
Mm.
And Gladys, by all accounts, was mentally and financially unprepared to raise a child.
Not at all. And that led to this devastating pattern of abandonment.
Which is really the crucial context here.
It is. Norma Jean's earliest years, from birth until about age 7, were spent with evangelical Christian foster parents, the Bolanders, out in Hawthorne.
And that ended around 1933 when Gladys tried to sort of get her life together.
Yeah, she managed to buy a small house in Hollywood, and Norma Jean moved in with her. But this brief attempt at normalcy just completely collapsed in January 1934.
That's when the instability became institutional. That's when Gladys suffered a severe mental breakdown.
A very severe one. She was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia.
And committed.
That's right. She was committed to the Metropolitan State Hospital. And from that moment on, she spent the rest of her life constantly moving in and out of care.
Which left Norma Jean a legal ward of the state.
Mm-hmm. And that history, you know, of mental health struggles and institutionalization, which Norma Jean saw firsthand, it would tragically echo later in Marilyn's own life.
When she faced her own mental health crises, yeah.
Exactly.
And what followed was just this grueling, grim rotation of homes and, well, documented trauma.
That's awful. The period immediately after her mother's commitment, she lived with these lodgers, the Atkinsons. And this is where many biographers believe she first experienced sexual abuse.
And the psychological impact was immediate.
Immediate and profound. The trauma caused her to develop a severe stutter and become incredibly withdrawn.
Just a child.
Yeah. And by the summer of 1935, after these brief, failed stays with a few different families, Gladys's friend, Grace Goddard, placed Norma Jean in the Los Angeles Orphans Home.
And even though the institution itself was described as well-run, a model institution, they called it.
Right.
The feeling for Norma Jean must have been just one of total abandonment.
That feeling of being disposable, of being shuffled around. I mean, that defined her emotional landscape.
And she was only there for about a year and a half.
Right, before Grace Goddard pulled her out, but the message was clear. You're unwanted.
And the rotation didn't stop.
No. She moved back in with the Goddards. But this second stay ended very quickly because Grace's husband, Erwin Dockedard, allegedly molested her.
Oh, perfect.
So she was then bounced between relatives and friends of Grace for years, never staying anywhere long enough to feel rooted.
Constant emotional dislocation, always dependent on the kindness of strangers who, I mean, so often failed her.
Yeah.
But amidst this grim reality, the source material points to the genesis of her entire career, the movies.
This is where we see the budding artist using her imagination as really a crucial defense mechanism.
A refuge.
A total refuge. She would say, I didn't like the world around me because it was kind of grim. When I heard that this was acting, I said, that's what I want to be.
And she loved just sitting alone in the movie theater.
All day. Up front, where the screen felt huge and immersive, she'd be there all day and into the night. It was her only reliable escape from the reality of her life.
She was essentially practicing her future career by observing the glamour she was denied.
Exactly.
And this leads us to the inevitable pressure cooker of 1942 and a decision that just irrevocably changed her life.
Marriage at age 16.
A purely pragmatic, almost desperate escape plan.
Completely. Doc Goddard's company relocated him to West Virginia, and crucially, California child protection laws prevented them from taking Norma Jean out of state.
So her only alternative to going back to the state-run orphanage was marriage.
That was it.
So she married their neighbor, James Daugherty, a factory worker, shortly after her 16th birthday in June 1942. A marriage of pure necessity.
Correct. She avoided the institution, which was her immediate priority.
Right.
But the source describes the marriage as mismatched and profoundly limiting for her.
She later lamented to friends that she was dying of boredom.
Mm. It shows that stability, while she wanted it, it wasn't enough to satisfy the fierce ambition that was already stirring inside her.
And that marriage only lasted 4 years.
But it bought her the space and time she needed to launch the next completely new phase of her life.
That boredom was interrupted very decisively in 1944 when Daugherty enlisted in the Merchant Marine.
And shipped out to the Pacific.
Yeah. This moment of separation was the catalyst, wasn't it? It gave Norma Jean the physical and professional independence she craved.
It was the moment she realized she had agency. She moved in with her in-laws, took a job at the radio plane company, a munitions factory.
I mean, the irony of working in a factory, making aerial targets for the military, only to become a global target of the media.
It is striking, isn't it?
And it was at the factory that she was discovered, purely by chance.
Yes. She met a photographer, David Conover, who was shooting morale-boosting pictures of, you know, attractive female workers for the U.S. Army Air Force's first motion picture unit.
But her photos didn't even make it into the campaign.
No. But Conover recognized this unique photogenic quality she had. And he encouraged her.
And she seized that opportunity with a force of will that just completely contradicts that fragile image we have of her.
Oh, completely. She quit the factory in January 1945, defying her husband who was deployed, and his disapproving mother moved out on her own and started modeling for Conover and his friends.
By August 1945, she signed with the Blue Book Model Agency.
And the agency, they determined her figure was perfect for pinup modeling. You know, the kind that was popular with servicemen.
Not high fashion.
Not high fashion, no. But she embraced this fully. She understood the power of that specific type of visual appeal.
And this is when the true intentional physical transformation began. This wasn't just, you know, a casual dye job.
Oh, it was calculated. She straightened her naturally curly brown hair and dyed it platinum blonde.
Wow.
And the agency owner, Emmeline Sneavely, she attested that Marilyn became almost frighteningly ambitious and disciplined.
She was no longer Norma Jean.
She was creating the prototype. By early 1946, she was appearing on dozens of magazine covers, sometimes testing out names like Jean Norman.
The modeling success opened the door to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. In June 1946, she signed with an acting agency, which led to a screen test at 20th Century Fox.
And a Fox executive, Ben Lyon, was impressed.
He was. And they signed her, partly just to keep her away from RKO Pictures. Their head, Howard Hughes, was also interested in her.
And this led to the iconic name change in August 1946.
A fusion of old Hollywood glamour and her own personal history. Marilyn was suggested by Lyon because she reminded him of the star Marilyn Miller.
Right.
And Monroe was her mother's maiden name, a nod to her biological roots.
The moment that career path was set, the personal life had to be cleared away. She divorced Daugherty in September 1946.
He opposed her career path. That commitment just speaks volumes.
It really shows she was already prioritizing her engineered future over her past and any kind of fleeting stability.
And she then spent her first 6 months at Fox just intensively studying acting, singing, dancing.
She studied at the Actors Laboratory Theater.
Right, where she found her first taste of what real acting in a real drama could be. She was, in her own words, hooked.
But her coaches at the time, they still thought she was too shy, too insecure for the big screen.
They did. They often preferred the technical polish of the old studio system to her raw emotionality.
And this is key. She was initially considered a weak actress.
Very weak. Her early contracts, first at Fox, then later at Columbia Pictures, they were short-lived, precisely because the head of Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck, he just didn't see her potential at first.
Yet she continued to study diligently.
Constantly. She worked closely with a drama coach named Natasha Leitz until 1955. She was always trying to improve the craft that Hollywood seemed determined to deny her.
Okay, so let's talk about the defining moment that launched her from, aspiring contract player to a household name.
The calendar scandal.
Which she handled with just incredible strategic skill.
The nude calendar scandal, yeah.
Yeah.
After her Columbia contract ended in 1949, she was genuinely broke.
Desperate.
Completely. She posed for a set of artistic nude photographs for Tom Kelly for $50. She's the pseudonym Mona Monroe.
$50, just to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to March 1952. She's starting to gain traction, and the press breaks the story. This should have been a career-ending crisis in conservative 1950s America.
And this is where the shrewdness of Marilyn Monroe truly emerges. Fox and Monroe handled this masterfully.
Instead of denying it.
Which would have led to an immediate witch hunt. Yeah. She and her team decided to preempt the damage by admitting she had posed, but stressing she had been completely broke and desperate at the time.
So she framed it as a story of survival, a working class girl doing what she had to do to eat.
Exactly. And that strategy immediately gained her public sympathy. She was relatable, not just some decadent star. And crucially, it dramatically increased public interest in her films.
It turned a potential disaster into a massive marketing win.
A huge one. Suddenly, she was getting top billing, featured on the cover of Life magazine as the talk of Hollywood. They dubbed her the Cheesecake Queen turned box office smash.
And at the same time, she was actively fighting the pigeonhole that she had just created.
Right. While she was earning titles like Miss Cheesecake of 1951, she was studying with serious teachers like Michael Chekhov and the mime Lotte Gosler.
And she demonstrated this range early in 1952. She took roles that explicitly contradicted the bombshell image.
She did, like playing a fish cannery worker in the film Noir Clash by Night, which earned her positive reviews.
And a mentally disturbed babysitter in the psychological thriller Don't Bother to Knock.
Yeah, she was desperately trying to show Hollywood there was more depth beneath the platinum exterior.
But this era also saw the beginning of her infamous reputation for being difficult.
The lateness, forgetting lines, demanding retakes.
People often reduce this to just simple diva behavior, but it's more complex.
It's a very complex reaction. Biographers now recognize it as a combination of crippling stage fright, low self-esteem fueled by years of rejection, and her perfectionism.
Which manifested as anxiety.
And perhaps most significantly, it stemmed from her deep dislike of the lack of creative control on film sets, especially when directors were condescending or dismissive.
And we also see the start of her attempts to self-medicate.
Turning to barbiturates, amphetamines, and alcohol to cope with chronic insomnia and anxiety. The severe addiction issues didn't fully take hold for a few more years, though.
It's essential context, though. As writers like Sarah Churchwell noted, some of this difficult behavior was also a necessary defense mechanism against the condescension and sexism she endured.
It was an early, disorganized attempt to assert control in a system designed to exploit and discard her.
So 1953 was the year Marilyn Monroe became an absolute global force.
Absolutely. She solidified the blonde bombshell persona and became one of Hollywood's most bankable performers.
Complete with the trademark look. Those dark arched brows, the pale skin, red lips, and that iconic beauty mark.
And the films from this year are the very definition of that bombshell persona. First, there was the film Noir Niagara.
Which overtly relied on her sex appeal. It featured scenes that were considered, truly shocking for the era.
Oh, yeah. Her character's body covered only by a sheet or a towel.
And the studio marketed that aggressively. They used the iconic 30-second long shot of her walking with that distinctive hip sway as the core of the marketing campaign.
It was a successful gamble. Women's clubs protested the film as immoral, but audiences just flocked to it.
The New York Times Review commented dryly that the falls in Miss Monroe are something to see.
Noting that while she might not be the perfect actress at this point, She can be seductive even when she walks. The walk itself became a globally recognized piece of performance art.
She immediately followed that up with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes,
which cemented the dumb blonde persona, where she played the gold-digging Lorelai Lee.
This was the film that truly launched her into the stratosphere, wasn't it?
It was. Fast, eclipsing Betty Grable, who had been Fox's biggest blonde star in the 40s. Her performance of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is legendary. It's still considered the definitive cinematic portrayal of that trope.
And then came How to Marry a Millionaire, co-starring Grable and Lauren Bacall.
This was a massive technical and commercial win. It was only the second film ever released in CinemaScope, showcasing her on this giant immersive screen.
And it became her biggest box office success up to that point.
Mm-hmm. She was declared the top 10 money-making star for both 1953 and 1954. Fox historian Aubrey Solomon called her the studio's greatest asset, alongside the new CinemaScope technology.
But wait, if she was the studio's greatest asset, generating billions in today's dollars, how is she being paid? Because the sources suggest she was being exploited financially.
Massively exploited. Her original 1950 contract paid her far, far less than others of her stature.
That's the typical studio system contract, right? Long-term, high volume.
And low control. On top of the financial constraints, studio head Daryl F. Zanuck actively disliked her. He referred to her simply as the body.
And he resisted giving her any serious dramatic roles, cementing the typecast she hated?
Exactly. And this exploitation even extended into her personal imagery. In December 1953, Hugh Hefner launched Playboy using her.
Without her consent.
He featured her 1949 nude photos as the centerfold and cover of the very first issue, and she did not consent to that publication. Her image was being used to launch a cultural revolution without her permission or payment.
It perfectly illustrates her lack of control over her own image despite her fame.
Mm.
That brings us to the boiling point in January 1954 when Fox suspended her for refusing to shoot the musical comedy The Girl in Pink Tights.
She was drawing a line in the sand.
And this is where we see her strategic brilliance emerge under immense pressure. She understood that she needed a distraction, a huge counter-narrative, to fight the negative publicity.
So she married retired baseball star Joe DiMaggio on January 14, 1954.
The American sweetheart and the retired baseball legend, an instantly high-profile marriage.
It was a perfect piece of public relations. And she followed it up with the most improbable honeymoon imaginable.
A trip to Japan combined with a USO show in Korea.
Where she sang for over 60,000 U.S. Marines over 4 days in freezing temperatures.
Wow.
DiMaggio reportedly hated the entire spectacle. He couldn't stand the sight of other men looking at her.
But the strategy worked. She generated this enormous positive publicity wave that she leveraged perfectly against the studio suspension.
It was a short-term win. She settled with Fox, they promised a new contract, and she agreed to star in The Seven-Year Itch in 1955.
And that production gave us perhaps the most iconic image of her career.
The subway grate scene on Lexington Avenue.
They staged that whole thing right out in the open in Manhattan, attracting nearly 2,000 spectators.
Which put her instantly on international front pages. It was pure, raw publicity.
But here's where it gets really interesting. That sheer massive display of public attention.
That crystallization of her sex symbol status.
This was catnip for the press, but it was absolutely poison for her already troubled relationship with DiMaggio.
Mm. The union was defined by his extreme jealousy and documented physical abuse. The public triumph marked the immediate end of her marriage.
So the highest peak of her fame led directly to a devastating personal collapse.
Mm-hmm. She filed for divorce in October 1954. And after finishing The Seven-Year Itch, she made her defining revolutionary power move against the studio system itself.
She left Hollywood.
Moved to New York, and with photographer Milton Green, she founded Marilyn Monroe Productions, or MMP, in late 1954.
This wasn't just a vanity project. This was a direct, calculated assault on the standard studio contract.
It changed everything. Standard contracts locked actors into seven-year terms where the studio owned their image, controlled their roles, and dictated their salary.
And Monroe, by forming her own company, she unilaterally asserted that she was no longer under contract to Fox.
Right, and that she would choose her projects. This action, historians agree, was instrumental in the eventual collapse of the studio system.
She basically set the precedent for star independence.
She did. She clearly stated she was tired of the same old sex roles. And she spent 1955 immersing herself in serious acting, studying method acting under Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio.
where she grew very close to Lee and his wife, Paula.
This was another layer of her strategic reinvention. She embraced the Strasbourgs, who became her crucial new influences.
And method acting, which was still relatively new and often ridiculed by Hollywood.
Right. It required actors to confront and use their emotional traumas in their performance. For Norma Jean, who had decades of unresolved trauma, this was deeply compelling.
But also incredibly destructive. And by the end of 1955, Fox capitulated. The studio simply couldn't afford to let their greatest asset remain a revolutionary in New York.
They had no choice but to negotiate on her terms. The new 7-year contract was revolutionary for the time.
$400,000 for 4 films.
A massive increase. Plus the right to choose her own projects, directors, and cinematographers.
And the freedom to make 1 MMP film for every completed Fox film.
Time magazine acknowledged this stunning victory. They called her a shrewd businesswoman. She not only survived the system, she publicly beat it.
So having won the professional war, she began 1956 by formalizing her identity.
She legally changed her name to Marilyn Monroe on February 23rd.
But this entire period is really defined by her push into intellectual circles, specifically her marriage to playwright Arthur Miller in June 1956.
This was the ultimate collision of high culture and low culture. The union the media immediately nicknamed Egghead Weds Hourglass.
And this marriage wasn't just a personal choice, was it? It was a conscious statement about her intellectual aspirations.
And her desire to be taken seriously beyond the confines of Hollywood glamour.
And the studio, Fox, actually urged her to end the affair because Miller was being investigated by the FBI for alleged communism.
The political context here is vital. This is the era of the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC.
And Miller had been subpoenaed.
The studio was terrified of being associated with blacklisted individuals fearing financial disaster. But Monroe refused to back down.
It was a tremendous act of loyalty and political defiance.
And the FBI, because of her association with Miller, even opened a file on her. Though they concluded her leftist views, if she held them, were not actively used by the Communist Party.
She was searching for a deeper connection, a stability that Hollywood couldn't offer.
Mm-hmm. And she converted to Judaism to be part of Miller's family, explicitly identifying with the Jewish people as a dispossessed group.
That shows her searching for identity and solidarity.
But this conversion was significant geopolitically. Egypt banned all her films until their divorce in 1961.
Wow.
Yeah.
Her first film under that new, powerful contract marked a true triumph as a serious actress, Bus Stop in 1956.
This was the test case for the new serious Marilyn. She played Cherie, a complex, vulnerable saloon singer.
With an Ozark accent and intentionally non-glamorous costume.
And the director, Joshua Logan, who had been skeptical, was completely converted by her performance. He compared her talent to that of Charlie Chaplin in her ability to blend comedy and profound tragedy.
That critical reception must have been profoundly validating for her.
Immense. Bosley Crowther, one of the most powerful critics of the era, proclaimed, "Hold on to your chairs, everybody, and get set for a rattling surprise. Marilyn Monroe has finally proved herself an actress."
And she got a Golden Globe nomination. She had achieved the serious recognition she'd been fighting for since she first enrolled in the Actors Laboratory.
She had. But the fight for respect was far from over, as evidenced by the absolute spectacular conflict that defined her first independent MMP production.
The Prince and the Showgirl.
1957, co-starring and directed by the venerable Sir Laurence Olivier.
The tension was immediate and historic. It was a clash between the old theatrical guard and the new method vulnerability.
Olivier, who viewed her talent as entirely physical, patronized her on set. He said, "All you have to do is be sexy."
And Monroe, armed with her new contract and her method training, she retaliated.
She retaliated by being deliberately late and uncooperative. It was a professional declaration of war against the condescension of the established elite.
A conscious pushback. She explicitly stated to the press that if you don't respect your artists, they can't work well.
Right. She was fighting for the respect that her talent demanded. However, this professional struggle came at a crippling personal cost.
Her pharmaceutical dependence increased dramatically.
And she suffered a miscarriage during the grueling shoot.
Yet, despite the onset conflict and all that chaos, the film itself was critically acclaimed.
Especially in Europe, yeah. It earned her a BAFTA nomination and the David Di Donatello Award.
The irony is that the chaos produced great art.
And following the shoot, she took an 18-month hiatus. She suffered intense personal losses during that time, including an ectopic pregnancy and another miscarriage, likely linked to her chronic endometriosis.
We see just how serious her physical struggles were, given that she actually had a clause in her new contract allowing her time off during her period.
Her body was failing her under the pressure of the career she had engineered. She was also briefly hospitalized for a barbiturate overdose during this time, showing the incredible fragility beneath the professional successes.
And she even bought out Milton Green's share of MMP.
After they disagreed on how to run the company, yeah. Proving she was determined to maintain that hard-won professional control, even if it meant isolating herself.
Despite the struggle, she returned to Hollywood for the greatest commercial and critical success of her career.
Some Like It Hot, 1959.
Billy Wilder's cross-dressing comedy. And she initially resisted the role of Sugar Cane.
She did. She viewed it as yet another iteration of the dumb blonde part she hated.
So why did she take it?
She only accepted after Miller encouraged her, and she was offered a substantial 10% cut of the firm's profits.
So she would financially benefit from the typecasting she was forced to endure.
Exactly.
And the production for this film became legendary for its difficulty. The stories from the set are absolute Hollywood lore.
Famously so. She was often hours late, sometimes requiring dozens of takes for simple scenes. Tony Curtis famously compared kissing her to kissing Hitler because of the endless retakes.
Kissing Hitler, I mean, that's vicious, but it tells you so much about the chaos. How did Wilder manage to extract genius out of a set that was, by all accounts, hellish?
Wilder, despite his frustration, he recognized her unique quality. He noted that even though she didn't know her lines, she delivered a performance that just transcended the text.
She had an ineffable, magical quality on screen
that no amount of studio discipline could replace.
So what does this all mean? She's difficult, but the result was undeniable magic.
Precisely. The film was a massive, critical, and commercial hit. It earned her the Golden Globe for Best Actress. Variety called her a comedian with that combination of sex appeal and timing that just can't be beat.
It was the ultimate commercially successful expression of the persona she had created.
Even as the personal cost continued to mount.
After Some Like It Hot, the success momentum began to falter noticeably. Her next project, Let's Make Love in 1960, was done only to fulfill her Fox contract, suffered major delays, and was marked by a widely reported affair with co-star Yves Montand.
Critics were unimpressed. Bosley Crowther found her rather untidy and lacking her old Monroe dynamism. It was also unsuccessful at the box office.
And crucially, she lost the role of Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, because producers feared she would complicate the production. That's a sign that her reputation for being unpredictable was now actively destroying her career opportunities.
Her last completed film, The Misfits from 1961, was written by Arthur Miller specifically for her as a dramatic vehicle.
Which sounds like an emotionally charged environment already, even before cameras started rolling.
An emotional disaster zone. Filmed in the oppressive Nevada desert heat, the entire production was plagued by personal trauma.
Her marriage to Miller was ending. He was already openly involved with the on-set photographer.
Anna Moreau resented the character of Roslyn.
Which was partly based on her own vulnerabilities, yeah. She struggled constantly with Miller rewriting scenes the night before filming, leaving her incapable of memorizing new dialogue.
And her health crisis was just spiraling out of control during this shoot.
Her health crisis was severe and impossible to hide. She was dealing with intense pain from gallstones, and her drug addiction was so acute that she was regularly receiving high doses of barbiturates.
The anecdotes from the set are terrifying.
They are. Makeup artists had to apply her makeup while she was sleeping under the influence of the drugs. Filming had to be halted entirely so she could spend a week in a hospital detox to stabilize.
Despite all the chaos and the personal collapse, what was the ultimate critical judgment on her performance in The Misfits?
Her co-workers and the director, John Huston, they recognized the raw truth in her acting. Huston said that when she was acting, she was not pretending to an emotion. It was the real thing.
But initial reviews were mixed.
They were. Some critics, like Crowther, called her completely blank and unfathomable. But modern critics now regard it as the most mature interpretation of her career.
And the film is a classic. It was a performance fueled by her real-life breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Following the film, she divorced Miller in January 1961 and spent that year focused almost entirely on her health, undergoing surgeries and hospitalization for depression.
And she faced devastating setbacks even in her treatment.
Right. She was admitted to the prestigious Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic. It was mistakenly placed on a ward for psychosis, locked in a padded cell.
That environment was terrifying and re-traumatizing for her, echoing her mother's institutional history.
It was. But the kindness of her past stepped in a very surprising reversal.
Her second ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio,
rushed in, secured her release, and helped move her to a more suitable center. This act of care, this fierce protective friendship, it contrasts so sharply with the brief, tempestuous, abusive marriage they had years earlier.
It shows how deep the bond of their shared history ran.
It did.
She then purchased her famous home in Brentwood, Los Angeles, 12305 Fifth Helena Drive, and returned to work in 1962 for Fox's ill-fated Something's Gotta Give.
A disastrous attempt at a comeback, plagued by suspicion and hostility. She was already sick with sinusitis before filming began, but Fox was highly suspicious and pressured her to continue.
They accused her of faking illness.
Yeah. They were especially keen to scapegoat her because the studio was hemorrhaging money due to the spiraling costs and delays on the epic production of Cleopatra.
The famous non-film public appearance came in May 1962.
Yes, the happy birthday, Mr. President moment for JFK at Madison Square Garden.
She wore that stunning, sheer, skin-tight, rhinestone-covered dress.
And this highly visible break from the set further enraged the Fox executives, who viewed it as a gross professional dereliction of duty.
Shortly after, she generated her final piece of strategic publicity, filming a nude swimming pool scene for Something's Gotta Give.
This was a deliberate act of image control, seizing the narrative back from the studio. It made her the first major star to pose nude at the height of their career, generating enormous global buzz.
But the studio was out of patience.
Completely. When she took yet another sick leave, Fox fired her on June 7th and sued her for a huge $750,000.
And the production shut down because her co-star, Dean Martin, refused to make the film with anyone else.
Forcing Fox to completely halt the project and openly blame Monroe and the press.
Yet even in the immediate aftermath of this firing, she was still so valuable that Fox regretted the decision.
And was actively negotiating a new contract with her, including plans for a biopic of Jean Harlow when she died. They knew they could not replace her.
Which brings us to the tragic conclusion. August 4th, 1962.
She was found dead at age 36 in her Brentwood home by her housekeeper, Eunice Murray, at around 3 a.m.
And the circumstances were immediately suspicious due to the delay in calling the police.
Her psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson, and physician were called first. When the police were finally notified around 4:25 a.m., she was found nude in bed, covered by a sheet, her hand clamped around the telephone receiver.
The cause of death was definitively ruled as acute barbiturate poisoning.
Specifically, several times, the lethal limit of chloral hydrate and pentobarbital found in her blood and liver.
And due to the extremely high dosage, the ruling was a probable suicide.
Her doctors reported a history of severe fears, depressions, unpredictable mood changes, and previous overdose attempts.
Her death was global front page news. It created immediate and widespread shock.
It is truly chilling that the suicide rate in Los Angeles reportedly doubled that month.
Her death unleashed this massive public outpouring of grief and speculation.
It did. And Joe DiMaggio arranged the private funeral, pointedly barring most of Hollywood, believing they were directly responsible for her demise.
And while conspiracy theories about murder or accidental overdose proliferated for decades.
Right. A major threshold investigation by the L.A. County District Attorney in 1982 found no credible evidence of foul play, confirming the original probable suicide ruling.
We have traced the professional path she carved, but now we have to step back and look at the image she engineered and why it resonated so powerfully in 1950s America.
This persona was deliberately and brilliantly crafted by Monroe and Fox for the post-war male gaze.
Serving as a replacement for the aging Betty Grable, and offering a new, accessible form of sexuality.
And she consciously aligned herself with the ultimate 1930s bombshell, Jean Harlow. She even hired Harlow's hairstylist.
And her persona focused entirely on the blonde stereotypes, the dumbness, the naivete, the sexual availability.
And even the artificiality, all delivered with that breathy, childish voice and signature double entendres or Monroeisms.
Those Monroeisms were a critical part of the branding, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. When she was famously asked what she had on in the nude photo shoot, her reply, "I had the radio on," projected an innocence that made her overt sexuality seem natural and without danger.
This contrasted sharply with the dangerous, mysterious femme fatales of the 1940s. She embodied a specific version of the American dream.
She did. Her carefully cultivated stories of rising from a working-class broken childhood made her seem far more accessible, the ideal playmate, than her contemporary, the sophisticated upper-class blonde Grace Kelly.
Monroe stood for a brand of classless glamour available to anyone using American cosmetics, nylons, and peroxide.
She became the physical symbol of Populux and American consumer culture itself.
But the expert consensus is clear. The image of the dumb blonde was the biggest, most successful piece of acting she ever pulled off.
That and the ultimate contradiction. Biographers like Sarah Churchwell and Lois Banner are definitive. The biggest myth is that she was dumb. The second is that she was fragile. The third is that she couldn't act.
She was incredibly smart, highly literate, and exceptionally tough.
You had to be, to manipulate, defy, and eventually defeat the mighty studio system.
And she constantly signaled that self-awareness to her audience. She parodied the sex symbol status she was forced to maintain.
She learned from Mae West's methods, that ability to be laughing at or mocking her own sexuality. That self-awareness is key to her genius.
Think of the line she insisted be added to her dialogue in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
I can be smart when it's important, but most men don't like it. That single line is a brilliant, self-aware critique of the 1950s gender politics that defined her career.
Culturally, she was massive. Virtually a household name for sex, perceived as a specifically American icon.
Compared to hot dogs, apple pie, or baseball.
And while the public saw the bombshell, she was deeply interested in politics and intellectual pursuits.
She was a registered Democrat, openly admired Abraham Lincoln, seeing him as a paternal figure she never had, and actively questioned Robert F. Kennedy about civil rights issues.
It demonstrates her serious intellectual engagement far beyond what her public image suggested. Finally, let's look at her legacy as an actress. The complexity of her career continues to divide critics decades later.
It does. Some, like David Thompson, found her body of work insubstantial, or, as Pauline Kael put it, relying on turning cheesecake into acting.
But other powerful voices, like Roger Ebert and Jonathan Rosenbaum, argue she was magical on screen.
A talented comedian who, quote, subtly subverted the sexist content of her material. Rosenbaum suggested that the difficulty people had in discerning her intelligence was actually rooted in the ideology of the repressive era she worked in.
Her intelligence was simply too threatening to be acknowledged alongside her overwhelming sexuality.
Exactly.
And the brand, of course, endures. She remains a hugely valuable, licensed brand from Chanel to Absolut Vodka.
Her conflicted image, the sex symbol versus the troubled victim, ensures she remains central to discussions about fame, feminism, and mass media. Her Los Angeles home was even designated a historic cultural monument in 2024.
She truly is the eternal shapeshifter. What an incredible, condensed journey through a life defined by extraordinary extremes. The sheer force of will it took Norma Jean to not only survive an unstable childhood, but to achieve the global fame of Marilyn Monroe.
And then to fight tooth and nail for control of that persona.
It's astonishing. She leveraged her sexuality to gain power and autonomy, only to be profoundly damaged by the very public machinery she helped elevate and ultimately attempted to dismantle.
The complexity of her duality just cannot be overstated. She was simultaneously a hyper-aware producer of her own iconic image, the shrewd businesswoman who used MMP to beat Fox, and a profoundly damaged individual struggling with severe addiction and debilitating mental health challenges.
All rooted in her childhood trauma.
Right. Her genius lay in her ability to synthesize high culture through her associations with figures like Arthur Miller and Lee Strasberg, with the most potent symbols of low culture and pinup glamour. She mastered the performance of celebrity before anyone else.
It's a devastating arc that makes you wonder about the future she was aiming for, especially given the seriousness of her final professional negotiations.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of her final years, founding MMP, winning control, signing a new contract, and actively seeking serious dramatic roles like the Jean Harlow biopic, this raises an important question for you to think about.
Right.
Had Marilyn Monroe lived beyond 36, could the shrewd businesswoman have completely overthrown the dumb blonde persona, redefining her legacy in the 1960s as a serious dramatic force, much as she had redefined her contract status in the 1950s? We leave that for you to mull over.